Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Bonnie Brady, Executive Director of the Long Island Commercial Fishing Association. She lives in Montauk, New York, with her husband, a commercial fisherman, and their two daughters. Today, we're going to talk about offshore wind. So can you, well, offshore wind energy. So first off, thank you for your work in the world. Second, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you very much for having me, Derek. I really appreciate it.
So would you rather talk about, just dive into what is wrong with wind energy, or would you rather talk about how you got started?
I think maybe how I got started might be a good segue into this whole thing, if that's okay by you.
Sounds great.
Okay. Well, let's see. I grew up in New Jersey, spent the formative years there, and then went to college in South Carolina. From there, I wound up moving after school to DC, and I have a journalism degree from the University of South Carolina. So I started looking for a J school job. At the time, it was 1984, and everyone was kind of firing. So I wound up doing a variety of jobs in DC, and then I finally landed a job working on the Hill in 1987. I was working for Bill Bradley, Senator Bradley of New Jersey, his office. And I did that for about 2 years. And then from there, I moved back to Montauk, where my family had moved to at that point. My parents were splitting, and I was going to come home and help my mother with my younger siblings. So I did that for a while. And at the same time, I had applied to go to the Peace Corps. And I, once I got up here, I accepted a job in 91 to become a health volunteer in Bangbis in Cameroon. And I did that for about 2 years. And then I came back to Montauk. Before I left for the Peace Corps, and when I got back, I worked for our local newspaper, the East Hampton Star, for about a year before and a year after. And when I got back from the Peace Corps, I then wound up, I was about to try to get into med school. I had to go back and take some science classes because I passed that time period that you have to before you take the MCAT. So I was taking some of those when my twin brothers decided to wrap a car around a tree instead. So I wound up taking off from school and helping my mom again take care of them. And then I wound up going instead into the paramedic program at Stony Brook. And I became a paramedic, and actually the first paramedic in Montauk. We're volunteer. And I did that. And then in the interim, I met my husband, a commercial fisherman. And the rest is kind of history. When after we got married, they were planning on creating a new fishing group from Montauk, that is the New York State's largest commercial fishing port. And Long Island is where 99% of all of New York's seafood is landed. And they were planning on re-upping a new group. And there were about 20 people or 25 people in the room. And they were all talking about the issues they had with various regulatory bodies. And me, being the silly one, picked up the chalk and started asking them, okay, if we could think of the top five, what are they, to kind of focus everyone's thoughts? And unfortunately, that was it. At that point, I kind of got made the executive director of the group, and it's been a wild ride since. There you go. That's about it, until we came to offshore wind and our first introduction to that, which was in 2003. They wanted, at that point, LIPA, Long Island Power Authority, wanted to put 200 megawatts of 2-megawatt turbines inside of 3 miles of water right in the middle of our squid grounds. And that's how it started for me.
So let's start with, we can talk about other creatures besides humans in a minute, but let's talk about how wind affects. Why do fishermen care about wind energy?
Oh, gosh. Well, I mean, first and foremost, fishermen, contrary to what some may attest to, fishermen really do care about the environment in which they're working. And I think one of the biggest possible fallacies is that they don't care. I No, I've been involved now since 2000, 2001. And, these guys are very, very much a part of that environment. Most of them, they leave in the darkness and they come home in darkness and they go out to somewhere where very few people have the opportunity to work. And that's basically their office. So they are dependent on time and tide and weather more so than virtually almost any other group of people. And for those of us that do it in New York, in state or federal waters, they go out sometimes for days at a time. And so when they're out there, they really need to be very cognizant of weather, of forecasts, of times of year, of what I like to refer to as that traditional historic knowledge that has been bestowed upon them from decades and decades. From when, for example, my husband is just turned 67, he started fishing when he was about 15 years old. And for him, in addition to being outdoors and doing his job, he, really took the time to listen to the old timers, as it were, as far as in learning the tricks of the trade, learning how different times of year, how it brought different migrations of fish, what the weather meant, what the temperature, and how basically the ebb and flow of the ecosystem around Long Island. And I mean, frankly, not only just Long Island, but up toward George's Banks. It's a big ocean out there, and people that don't know it or don't see it with regularity don't really have an understanding of that three-dimensional life below the waterline. Excuse me. So, I know for these guys that are out there, being one with nature is a really big deal to most of them. I haven't met a guy to date that, does if they go out there because they love it. They love working hard. They love providing food. And they, most days when they don't get paid exactly what they want for their fish, they may question a little, but they still go back every day. It's not just a, it's a profession. It's really a calling for, I would say, the majority of them.
So thank you for that. And the question I was getting at is you said that they put the wind energy facilities in the middle of the squid area.
Right,
So
right.
how does that affect either their catch or the squid? One
Right.
leads to the other.
Right. Well, I mean,
So let's start with squid and then move out from there.
sure. First of all, squid, in this case, we're talking about Lalago, squid. They live a very short life, about 8 months. And fish, just like humans, are run by electricity and electric impulses. There's a lot that has been said of fish and migrations involving the magnetic, basically pull of the earth, which is about 520 milligauss. And so there's pretty much north-south lines for that magnetic field in and around Long Island, if you look at it on a map. And these migrations, I guess, that the fish have, it's a real concern on one front, just from putting thousands of miles of electric cable on the ocean floor and what that could do, whether or not the ability of those fish to be able to cross those cables or would they want to. We know that EMF, certain species like sharks and elasmobranchs, skates, etc., that's how they catch their prey based upon electrical impulses. And we don't know enough about squid. We do know that, for example, certain species during pile driving, which is something that is part of the construction and operation of a wind turbine, that's an extremely not only loud sound that can, but for a fish with a swim bladder, it can actually kill fish in within the near direction. We know that the particle motion of the water, when you have an explosive impact like a giant 4,000 kilojoule hammer that slams a giant, in this case, 850 foot steel hole into the ground, it's not just the sound that is deafening for certain fish or certain marine mammals, but for other fish and for larvae, the explosive pressure, if you can imagine like a centrifuge where you drop a drop of water and then the rings that come out of it, that's how the ocean would be affected when you have that impact. So you've got particle motion that in essence can, and they've done studies, a fellow named Andre had done as far as in lesions and having squid be affected by pile driving, where basically they swim off and then they die. So anything that would affect the migration of squid within Long Island is a huge issue. It's a $6 million a year fishery to New York fishermen. And it obviously not only is that, but squid are a huge forage fish for virtually everything else that eats.
So let's,
and by that, I mean other fish, whales, etc.
Let's back up a second and say two things just so we're clear. One of them is that one of the problems with, you said that they use electromagnetic, that they navigate through magnetic fields. And just so right. people know, one of the problems with electrical cable is that any electric current running through a wire or cable will create a magnetic field around it. I just wanted to make sure people know that.
Right.
And then the other thing is, do you happen to know, so there's three things. One is that. One is, do you happen to know the decibel level of these pile drivers?
I believe pile driving is somewhere between 240 and 250 decibels. And that is in low frequency sound. I know a lot, you'll hear a lot of information. I've seen a lot of kind of misinformation talking about, oh, don't worry about the whales. When we pile drive, we're going to put bubble curtains around the area so that less sound gets through. Unfortunately, bubble curtains don't work with low frequency sound, which is how baleen whales like the right whale or humpback whales or minke whales, that's how they hear. You've got middle range toothed whales that hear at a little bit of a higher frequency, and so they won't be as affected by it. And they do believe the startle response for a lot of dolphins and or porpoises, but it really depends as to when they start. I mean, the amount of turbines that there's approximately 24 wind lease areas right now that they have in the hopper from the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management. And if all of those lease areas are built out, they think approximately 3,500 turbines from Maine down to South Carolina, all across the Atlantic Ocean. And then when you do the pile driving for that, that's usually anywhere between 35 and 55 strikes per minute, where a steel tower can possibly, depending upon the substrate, meaning the bottom, can be put in within, I believe it is 2 to 3 days per pile. So, you know, this is basically creating a giant construction zone out of the ocean. It's not going to be something with the projects the way they have them stacked up. They are supposed to start south of Nantucket. The Vineyard Wind project, I believe, is supposed to start pile driving in May of this year, or excuse me, it might be in September. And the projects are one by one coming up so that there might not be a time within the next several years that you don't have pile driving going on throughout an area of the ocean that's never had anything resembling this. The reality is what they say they're going to do is start with a ramp up a period where, you know, we've had a whole issue with whales on the East Coast. For the construction, they talk about the ramping up of the machinery for the pile driving while they have protected species observers on board. But let's face it, whales, you know, to see if something spouts. However, for the most part, whales, you know, they kind of spend most of their time in the water. True, they breathe, but as far as in being able to have a really good understanding as to who's and what and where. You know, we've got projects right now. There's one they're trying to, the South Fork Wind Farm, that's on cod grounds. We're spawning stock population level concerns by National Marine Fisheries Service and the feds, the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, that are in charge of this, basically overrode the National Marine Fisheries Service concerns. We've had a similar issue with Vineyard Wind site with the North Atlantic right whale, in which they had suggested a buffer of 20 nautical miles before that they would allow for any pile driving so that the right whales would be able to have the ability to forage on their main species, which I believe are copepods. And they ignored that too. So at the moment, it's pretty much, you know, we're trying in many ways through a zillion comment letters from the very beginning to address some of these issues. It just doesn't seem that anything we say is going to matter. I believe Deb Haaland, who is the Secretary of Interior, several months back when they talked about trying to get a certain number by 2030, and you know, the question was, well, you know, how is it going to happen? And her response is, well, we'll get it done. And it doesn't seem like suddenly the ocean doesn't really matter. You know, all of the things that from our fisheries perspective, which is based on the precautionary principle, kind of like a camper's version of do no harm, has always been the rule of the land when it comes to quotas for species and, you know, determining how much catch can be taken out and allowing the spawning stock biomass to continue to replicate, and other habitat issues, whether it's a certain gear type, whether you pull a net or whether you pull a dredge or whether you have hook and line, et cetera. And now suddenly these huge industrialized projects are coming through, and it's just, everyone's getting steamrolled.
Thank you for that. And I want to, go back to the observers on the ships. I mean, they may see a whale that comes up to breathe, but they're not going to see any fish or squid or anything else who are pulverized by, and you can't see, it's in the ocean. They could destroy an entire school of fish and you would never be any the wiser.
Right. Exactly.
As well as what happens to the sea floor.
Right. Which is basically in most cases, a sand shoal ecosystem. And people don't, you know, people don't understand. People are like, oh, but it's going to create reef, as if somehow the ocean is an aquarium. And you know, you're going to stick a little diver down and suddenly, you know, a little cement diver, and suddenly the goldfish are going to like it. The reason why the species that we catch in the mid-Atlantic are there is because of the sand shoal ecosystem. I mean, you've got in the New York Bight, you've got areas like Cholera Banks where you have sand mountains, literally, you know, tens of feet tall, up to 80 feet, I believe 90 feet tall in areas. And that's a consistently moving ecosystem. It's not like on land where you just see a mountain and the mountain necessarily always stays. With the ocean, obviously, water is the medium. And so current and wind and storms move things around. But for the most part, that's kind of part of the reason as to how everything moves, whether it's larvae, you know, through transport or just in general with, you know, upwelling and downwelling of the ocean. There are areas that the reason the fishermen go to them is because they are highly productive year after year. And that very specific ecosystem is going to be basically paved into a parking lot and then juiced with hundreds of thousands of miles of cables and steel in the water, which people think, oh, it's a reef. Well, no, it could be something called biofouling, which they found in these turbines in in Europe, in Denmark, et cetera. Horns Rev, I think, was one. And what people don't understand is when you create structure in the water where there isn't a lot of things tend to go stick on it. And in this case, for the Horns Rev project, it was mussels, but it wasn't just a little bit of mussels. It was like 10 to the third power of mussels. And they've done studies, a fellow named Hammer has done a study where they look at it, and depending on if there isn't enough current flow, you could actually create little dead zones from the amount of detritus as this giant group of mussels grow larger and larger without any other, type of animal eating them. So, you have a very delicate balance in the ocean that we've had in the US, for quite a long time. And now, in what only feels to me like basically it's a real estate grab, these wind energy areas or the giant substations they want to build offshore, all of these things on land, they don't have the facilities, they don't have the room, and they wouldn't be able to get the appropriate permitting done, probably because probably most people might not be too happy about getting all of this done right on top of them. So instead, they're looking to the ocean as basically the next real estate deal to put it out there where most people won't be able to see it and no one will be able to sound the alarm.
Can we back up a second again? And did you call
Certainly.
it Sand Shoals ecosystem? What was the name of the ecosystem that you said?
Sand shoal ecosystem, basically. You have a sand bottom, and the Mid-Atlantic Bight is mostly sand bottom. You do have some areas where you have structure, whether you have rocks or whether in like the inside hole off of Montauk, where you've got giant boulders. But as a generality, the area of the Mid-Atlantic Bight is basically one big sand spot.
Okay,
And
so can you tell us like who lives in there?
oh, you mean the
Who
types of fish?
yeah, and who has babies there, and the relationship between that and the larger
Right.
fishing
Oh,
community. I don't like
well,
I know nothing about that particular ecotype. Like I know redwood forests, I know
right.
some other ecotypes. I know zip about that. So can you introduce me to that ecotype, please?
I can, but I probably will not do the absolute best of jobs, but I'll try to cobble together what I know. I mean, within obviously, in any of these ecosystems, you've got, zooplankton, phytoplankton, but what you have in a sand environment that is very important to things like baleen whales are copepods. And they're little shelled creatures that basically kind of blown up almost look like a little shrimp, but they're not. And that is what the baleen whales, the right whales specifically, that's their favored food type. So what happens with the copepods is they have something really cool called a diel migration. And what they do as a group, and I've never seen this and I've just read about it, but basically they spend a certain amount of their time, and these are like microscopic little organisms. They spend a great deal of time on the bottom, and then in 12-hour shifts, then they tend to go up toward the top of the water column. And then after that, they go back down, almost like a sine curve, up and down. And basically, the right whales, they follow them. So sometimes they'll be feeding off of the top, and sometimes they'll be feeding off of the bottom. So in addition to that, you've got, species like herring and squid and other forage species, sand eels, et cetera. You have the fish that fishermen catch, which would be things like summer flounder, otherwise known as fluke. That's a flat white meat fish. You have porgies, which are also known as scup. You have, excuse me, black sea bass. That's one of those species that tends to like structure. But these are migratory species. So what they do is in the wintertime, they go offshore to the areas often in and around the shelf where the water is deeper and warmer. And then in the summertime, in the spring, they come back inshore. And that's when you've got spawning for a majority of those species, and they do those in inshore waters, nearshore waters. So for fishermen that fish, say, both in the, you know, not just in the summer and the springtime. If you fish all four seasons, basically the fishermen, they just move with the fish. So in the summer and the spring, as the fish come back, they may fish locally, or certain species that spend their time offshore all the time, certain species of squid, whether it's Ilex squid or Lalago squid. There are state waters where occasionally they show up in one year and you can have a bang up year of great squid runs, or there may not be, say, a squid run that year south of Long Island, but off of Nantucket, which is a huge area for the summer squid fishery. In some years, New York's caught 40 to 60% of their squid catch from the summer comes from that area. And that is also the area where the Vineyard Wind Project is taking place. And that's, we are a plaintiff in a lawsuit with Seafreeze of Rhode Island as the main plaintiff against the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management and others regarding that area. As far as in after you get to the species that humans eat, you know, obviously we've got tuna, you've got the canyons where you've got the tuna fish, they come in, they were really close this year. People were catching bluefin tunas within 10 miles of Montauk. It was pretty cool to watch, you know, plus then of course you've got the seals and the turtles and the whales and, you know, the diving birds, the water birds that are, you know, there are some birds like, I'm trying to remember the name of the one that my husband has had occasionally on his boat. Some of these diving birds, they spend their entire lives offshore. You know, it's a cornucopia. It's just what being on the water is, you know, every day is different and yet you can see some amazing things. So that's all part of the deal. Plus in the Mid-Atlantic Bight, we've got the Mid-Atlantic Cold Pool, which I don't know a ton about, other than it seems to be having a protective effect. It changes between the winter and the summer and helps to keep the waters of the Mid-Atlantic cooler so that we don't have as many issues with climate change. For whatever reason, the cold pool seems to contract and expand based on the season, and it has a protective aspect for the Mid-Atlantic Bight, which we're very thankful of.
So thanks for that introduction to that ecotype. And you already said this, but can you come back now, because I was a little bit slow and trying to figure out what the ecotype was when you were just talking about this. So what does putting in those structures do to those
It changes the ecosystem completely. In fact, John Hare, who is the chief scientist for the Northeast Fisheries Science Center, you know, had done articles. It basically changes it from a soft sand substrate to a hard bottom. It completely will change the ocean bottom. You've got giant cables, in some cases 340,000 volt cables, that are either being laid directly on the ocean floor, or occasionally they will be buried, which they say a target of 4 to 6 feet. But we know from Europe that, you know, if you're on the ocean and sand with shifting sands in a dynamic environment, that a lot of these cables become exposed. That's a regular type thing. Plus if there's free spans that exist. So you've got these cables emanating electromagnetic frequency. And obviously, in addition, there's areas where if they can't bury them, they plan on armoring them with boulders on top of them, or riprap, whatever they can have. So basically, you're taking an environment that's just like the sand between your toes and the beach and turning it into hard rock and everything that might attach itself to that. So you're really kind of, for certain species like fluke, or, you know, any of the squid, you've got them at the young of the larvae, and, you know, the squid, the summer flounder specifically, they come into the bays and nearshore waters in the spring in order to lay eggs. And then basically, flukes spend their life cycle on sand. That's where they're a flat fish. They lay in the sand, they don't move, they camouflage themselves to that area and wait for fish to come by that they can eat. And that's how they do it. Kind of almost like you've got like monkfish, which is like an angler fish. You might remember if you ever saw, I think it was the movie Finding Nemo, where they lay on the ground, they pretend they have a little lantern light, and then all of a sudden, when the fish goes near, they eat it. It's an eat or be eaten world, but these animals all exist in these areas because that's where their prey is and that's where they spend their lives. So if suddenly we change the bottom dramatically so it doesn't even resemble that which they go to spawn, what's that going to do to our stocks? I mean, first, you're going to pile drive it, then you're going to jet liquefy the ocean floor in order to lay this cable. And then in areas, you're going to armor it on top, and then you're going to juice it with 340,000 volts and see what happens. It's mind-boggling.
This is just terrible.
Yeah, it's
So,
real.
we still have like 15 minutes. So this sounds like a wind down question, but it isn't. Are there any other ways that this harms either fisheries or fishermen that we haven't talked about yet?
Oh, every yes, there's so many. Okay, let's
Okay, so
see.
go on. Yeah, please say some
Right.
more.
I mean, first of all, we know that it will mess the marine radar up completely. The National Academy of Sciences did a report last April in which they actually showed that, yes, we have for years have been saying that marine radar would not work inside a wind energy area. And it turns out that we would tap the developers like, oh no, you just have to fix the gain. There's nothing wrong with that. No. We've had pictures, we've had fishermen, even with the Block Island wind farm, that's just five turbines from here. They throw false targets and what's referred to as scatter, because basically radar picked on a site and then pings it back. So what happens, and instead of having dots on a screen representing turbines, what you basically have looks like a giant spiral graph instead. The problem being is that if you are outside of a wind energy area, you can see the area itself. However, for you, if you go inside, let's say in fog or in darkness, you don't know which dots are real versus false. So you won't be able to determine which are real targets and which aren't. So fishermen are not going to be going into turbine areas at all if they can't trust, because obviously these things are only a mile apart. We fought for a long time saying we needed at least 4 nautical miles of large pathways to allow us access, because when you're on the water, bad stuff happens. If you get a piece of rope caught in your wheel and suddenly, you don't, it's a boat. It doesn't have the ability to pull over, and you can, with a time or a bad storm, be pushed literally into hitting things. In addition, our high frequency radars, which are used for the ocean observatory systems throughout the US and also used to measure current height for things like tsunami alerts and for storms, those are going to be knocked out because those also are a line of sight radar. And these turbines are approximately 2 to 3 times larger than anything that they've used, except for more pr recently in Europe as part of the Horn Sea. So in Europe, they have little 4 or 5 megawatt turbines. These things are 14, they're saying between 12 and 14 megawatts. They're almost 900 feet tall. The blades are the size of a football field. And they've got, I think, about 7,000 pounds of rare earth minerals in each spinning around. It doesn't help as far as being able to see. So the high frequency radar conveniently is what the Coast Guard uses for Coast Guard search and rescue operations. There's a woman, they did a wind turbine radar interference mitigation workshop 2 years ago in the DOE, and the woman from the Coast Guard said very clearly, the model they use to determine if you're on a boat and you fall off a boat, they take the current height, meaning current of the water, how many, how tall it is, and they plug it into the model to determine where the hot zone is, where they think maybe the person that fell off the boat would be. Because a loss an error of 1 foot of current height is equal to a 24-kilometer error in the hot zone for searching. And they have no solution. They made it quite clear. There's a webinar. You can listen to them say it. And they literally have no solution as of yet as to how to fix this. So search and rescue isn't going to be able to help us. We aren't going to be able to go in there and be able to find our way at all. Then the best part is national security radar, which ARSR-4, and there's an ARS-8, I believe, which is our nation's first line of defense about 240 miles out. You've seen them possibly on the coast. Certain areas, they have those like giant golf ball radar. We have one in Riverhead. Those are going to be knocked out too, because the same thing, line of sight. If you build something taller than what the tallest building that we have it to be able to send that those reflections, you're not going to get through it. So yes, and let's not forget, we have terminal radar too, which is for airports, because the majority of intermediate airports haven't had new systems put in since the 70s. So a ton of these intermediate airports, Nantucket, Islip, et cetera, going to be a problem, because you still aren't going to be able to see what's coming at you. That's just radar. So, I mean, as far as in everything else, you know, we've got the cables, because, you know, the majority of the fish that is caught, I would say about 80% of the seafood that is caught in the U.S. is caught through either trawling or through clam or scallop dredging. And the last thing that you want to do if you're pulling a net is pull up a 340,000-volt cable, which could literally flip your boat and you could have a really bad day. And so the concern, we know, because in Europe, they have a site called Kingfisher where you can see all the various cables that have been exposed over time. I think 80% of the faults, the insurance claims, are due to exposed cables over in the UK, according to an insurance study I read about 2 years ago. So we're going to, unfortunately, lose all those grounds to these industrialized wind machines offshore. I mean, the Rhode Island, Massachusetts wind energy area is about 9 separate leases. It's off of you. It's about, I want to say, about 30 miles southeast of Montauk, and includes the South Fork Cox's Ledge project and also the Vineyard Wind project. It's not only the 9 leases together are not only larger than the state of Rhode Island, and or if you could put together all of Cape Cod plus Nantucket and Martha's Vineyard, it's 2/3 the size of the Grand Canyon National Park. And they want to put a turbine every 1 nautical mile in every direction. Now imagine that. You're standing on the vista looking at the Great Grand Canyon, and all you see are turbines, like Altamont on a bad day. They're putting them really on all of our most productive fishing grounds, because conveniently, literally all of these lease areas are being put where commercial fishermen fish, which is why it is the absolute largest threat to the future of domestic commercial fishing in the U.S.
So there's I'm gonna throw out 2 questions at once, and you can choose which one you want to do, either first or second, but I'd like to address both of them. You haven't really talked much about whales. Talked a little bit, but especially, like, there aren't many North Atlantic right whales left in the world. So I think, get, what is it, 100, 250?
300, I believe, a little less than 340 at present, right.
Okay, so if there's only 340 of a certain species, you would think you would care at least a little bit. So that's one thing I want to ask you about. Another one I want to ask you about is, you don't know me, so you might not know that I'm being sarcastic here, but we know that the federal government pays very close attention to public comments and to and cares very much what citizens think when it comes to a battle between citizens slash small business people versus large corporations.
Right.
So can you talk a little bit about the public input process? And so I know these are completely separate topics, so.
That's okay. I'll try to see if I can meld them together. I mean, the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, when they first came out with the lease area initially for the Rhode Island, Massachusetts area, and also the what they refer to as Empire Wind, you know, they did not at the time have any idea that even different states' fishermen all fished in one area. I was the one for the Empire Wind project that had to tell Bohm that there were at least six states of fishermen that were involved. We have been commenting since at least 2014 on every single project to date. And, you know, we've tried suing initially when they created a lease area. We know that the director of Bohm for the Empire project had an option with her director's memo. She could have opened the entire lease area for auction. And we had met with her and had several meetings with also members of Bohm. They could have removed an area of Area A due to commercial fishing because it was very important for scallop grounds, for squid grounds, for fluke grounds. And she could have also removed an area that was considered B for commercial fishing grounds, or she could have removed A and B because of commercial fishing grounds. And instead, she showed up in Islip, hit the gavel and said, I may not be a marine biologist, but I'm a history maker, and opened up the entire lease area. And that was it. And we tried suing, and the judge told us that it was not ripe as of yet because we did not know what the how many turbines they were going to be placing and where as of yet. So it that stopped.
That's a classic thing. I've done this when I've tried to fight illegal timber sales on the national forests, where they'll tell you during the larger forest planning process, they'll say, no, you don't fight this now. You fight this on the individual timber sale. And when it comes to the individual timber sale, they say, no, you're supposed to fight that at the planning process, not now.
Or we're told we have to wait until after the construction operation plan is set. Meanwhile, by the time they've done this, they've spent all this money, and basically the purchase power agreements are what are driving these lease areas. They say in the Bohm documents that is the clean energy standard of whichever state that is promoting this. That's what's driving the bus here. I mean, and people need to understand these leases are being leased by foreign government energy companies. We've got Dong Energy, Danish Oil and Natural Gas, which changed their name to Ørsted. And we divested ourselves of oil and gas. Well, no, actually they didn't. They divested themselves of upstream profits, as in they don't pump it out of the ground anymore. But downstream profits, like they got from Nord Stream 1 and 2 before whichever ones exploded, they were plenty part of that because that crossed over the Kingdom of Denmark's land. Then we've got Equinor, which used to be called Stat Oil, which is 67% owned by the Norwegian government. Or Vineyard Wind, which was created by Pension Denmark, one of the largest labor pension funds in Denmark, who created Copenhagen Infrastructure Partnership to be able to bid on these leases. Why? They bid on them, they take the money, they send all their own machinery, all their own boats, all their, you know, foreign nationals and their own crews, they strap the things on standing up and bring them over from Europe. And then when it's done, they reap the benefits, they farm it down to other corporations in pushing the ESG model. And then they just take that extra money and whatever's docked from the pay of their employees, and they do it all over again. This has absolutely nothing to do with saving anything. There are studies done in the North Sea that have shown that the wind wake effect, which is when the area of the lease up to 100 kilometers past the area is decreased in the amount of wind and the amount of current. So it's actually decreasing the upwelling and downwelling of the ocean, which is how you get that primordial goo that where everything grows. And as an added benefit, it's actually increasing sea surface temperature, which is imitating climate change. I mean, you can't make this up. You know, these things are only annually effective. People don't understand when they talk about a 1,000 megawatt project. That's nameplate. That's if it spins 24/7 at its highest rate ever. when in fact, annually, you only get about 38% of whatever that number is. So instead of 1,000, you only get 380 megawatts, more in the wintertime when we don't need the energy and less in the summertime when we do. Plus, you've got renewable energy credits. Those are going to whomever. They're apparently monetizing that. And I'm not a business major. I was a J school major. But I've been told that the renewable energy credits are somehow monetizing them and creating a derivative, which they're selling on the stock market. Now, when's the last time you and I heard the word derivative, and how well did that go? This is a giant house of cards. It's Denmark. It's 8.5% of their GDP. They have to keep feeding the beast. It's a giant Ponzi scheme. They keep building, they farm down, and they go to the next one. And people are none the wiser. Now, the right whale, you've got less than 340 left. They're a baleen species. They hear in low frequency, as do the minkies and the humpbacks. We've had about 25 humpback whales since December show up on a variety of shores during only the survey work, and yet are told directly by our federal government, we have no direct information to show that these whale deaths had anything to do with offshore wind. However, they issue incidental harassment authorizations where they literally say that level B harassment, which includes migratory pattern effects and harassment with regard to things like feeding and breeding and breathing and nursing, and this other thing called temporal shifts in hearing, otherwise temporary temporal shifts in hearing, otherwise known as temporary deafness. Now, I don't know, the joke that I made that isn't really funny is, well, how long is a whale temporarily deaf for? And maybe the answer is about as long as it takes to get hit by a ship. You've got these animals. We had one right whale, a young one that somehow got separated from its mother. It died. It was only about a week old. And then we had a 20-year-old male that started out in the Bay of Fundy that wound up in Virginia. And some of them are ship strikes. But the reality, if you talk to people on the water, if these animals are healthy, they see them all the time. They're very smart. They get out of the way. It's not like they're just hanging out there waiting to get hit, unless if they were compromised somehow. If you look at the profile for baleen whales in any of the documents that are included in those IHAs, you'll find out that there is absolutely no data supporting the fact that they don't know what these animals hear. In a document that I took a look at from 2019, where they were looking at the profiles because they'd done some changes with NOAA prior to this whole thing going on. And they specifically say in this document, this is Southall 2019, for low frequency cetaceans, no direct hearing data, behavioral or electrophysiological, were available at any frequency for any species. That is, there are no comprehensive directed measured audiograms for any baleen whale from which we can estimate a low frequency cetacean group audiogram, as was done for all other species groups. Basically, that means they've got nothing. So when they sit there and they tell the survey boats, okay, for a right whale, you've got to wait in a 500 meter barrier. If you see them, they have to be 500 meters away before you turn on your sparkers and boomers. And it turns out that a boomer is kind of like a mini air gun, not seismic where, you know, everything is dead in the past, but it's just a kinder and gentler version that requires a ramp-up process where they slowly turn the dial. Meanwhile, there's no oversight as to making sure at what dial number they hit it at. But yet for humpback whales, they've only been giving either 100 meters of a setback for the exclusion zone or 141, even though they don't have any profile at all to determine how far away they should be. Well, I wish I was making this up.
Even if they ramp it up, that's still there's if there's less than 350 of them, then they should be allowed to go wherever they want to go. And basically that's the equivalent with humans. It's like, we are going to ramp up noise until you're so miserable that you leave your home.
Right.
I mean, that's they're thinking this is a good thing, as though, oh, it's great, we didn't pulverize them with the sound. We just made them leave their homes.
Well, they think that the startle effect is going to take place for animals that, what, did they ask the whale? Meanwhile, 2 years ago, in 2020, 17 NGOs that have been suddenly all silenced now that all these dead whales are showing up on shore, wrote to NOAA and specifically said they had profound concerns with the cumulative impact of all of these surveys up and down the ocean on the right whale and other protected species of whales. Now suddenly, oh, wait, no, we didn't see anything. We haven't said anything. No, no, no. What do they call it? The, quote, cynical disinformation campaign, end quote. I don't understand quite the cynical definition, but whatever. And then in 2022, in December, when there was the draft policy for BOEM for right whales, they wrote in, and again, 15 groups said that they had profound concerns because of all of the surveys. Over 108 surveys had taken place since, I think, 2016 for the offshore wind. And they were concerned about the fact that the amount of animals that were harassed, both the right whale and other protected species, were not being considered. Now, meanwhile, when NOAA did the UME for, which is the unusual mortality event for humpback whales, that started in 2016, but they didn't declare it until 2017. And everyone, you know, from NOAA was like, oh no, survey work didn't happen before that started. That's a lie. They did two surveys in US Wind, did a survey in 2015 in Delaware and Maryland, and then in 2016. And they had three show up in Delaware in 2016. There was Bay State Wind, which was Dawn, which became Orsted. That was up by Massachusetts. They were surveying then. Plus, they were building the Block Island Wind Farm. But the best part, when you listen to the NOAA presser, the radio, the audio that they still have online of the presser from the UME, a reporter asked the question, well, this unusual mortality event, how many whales were getting hit by ships prior to this? Meaning, because that year in 2016, 10 whales had been hit by ships, 10 humpback whales. So when the reporter asked the question, well, before this, how many had gotten hit? 1.4 humpback whales per year had gotten hit by ships in 2015. That was the average up until the UME. In the first year of the UME, 10 had been hit. But nothing to see here. We have only authorized level B harassment, and that's their shield. As long as that's all they've authorized, they swear it had nothing to do with it. It's mind-boggling.
We're running out of time in more ways than one. And I hate to end on such a cliche note, but what can people do who care about this? How can they help your struggle and the struggle of other people to stop this madness?
I think what people need to do, I mean, there's a variety of groups that are popping up on the coast. And look, most people aren't aware of these things happening until literally the ships start appearing outside of their shores. And I don't blame people. This has been a highly quieted process in which the people that are commenting are either part of ENGOs that have been funded by offshore wind or a variety of other characters that have been funded to say, oh, it's green energy, it's great, it's good, let's keep going. There are groups that are popping up pretty much on each state, and people that are talking to their representatives, whether it's state, whether it's federal, to really start asking the hard questions. I mean, we've only right now at this point, two records of decision have been done, one for the Vineyard Wind project and one for the South Fork Wind project. The Vineyard Wind lawsuit has three or four lawsuits on it. South Fork Wind, I believe, has one lawsuit at present. And I know that the sites in New Jersey, a variety of them are also getting involved in lawsuits. I mean, you can go to, I would say, even though it seems like the social media, maven of Facebook, and you can look into it. I know that like Protect Our Coast New Jersey is one of the main ones, and groups have cropped up in Massachusetts now and in Delaware and Virginia. So people are starting, you know, the people that are going to be the most dramatically affected, the coastal communities. And they have, frankly, a lot of reasons too. People go to the beach to look at endless sunsets and endless sunrises, not to look at an industrial zone. And that is going to affect everyone that lives on the coast. I mean, no one should have to just take it on the chin for having to pay for the never-ending energy-sucking ways of urban folk, you know? And some of that obviously is just, and I know I looked at your book previously, you know, but this idea of whatever happened to conservation, you know, and it's such a huge issue. I lived overseas with no running water and no electricity. I know how important electricity is. It can guarantee for, you know, hospitals and clean running water and vaccines that kill a lot of kids, you know, at least where I was in sub-Saharan Africa. But we don't really need to just keep growing at such a rate that we can't turn lights off. And there's so much more that we could do. Instead, it just seems that we're just spinning out of control. I guess that hasn't really made much sense. If people want to, they can go to the Long Island Commercial Fishing Association page of Facebook or my own personal page. I have it on public. They can find me. I put up as many different news articles as I can find, scientific articles. Anything, put out information for groups, you know, be glad to be able to talk to anyone that would be willing to talk. This is literally the fight of our lives. And this is for the ocean and it matters.
Well, I think you made tremendous sense. I don't think you were muddled at all. Thank you so much for that. And thank you for your work and thank you for being on the program. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Bonnie Brady. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.